Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 8th of February, these are our main stories. Hamas counter-proposals for a hostages for ceasefire deal in Gaza are rejected by Israel's prime minister.
If we surrender to the crazy demands of Hamas, we'll not only not bring to their release, but we'll invite a second massacre, a great catastrophe for the state of Israel.
25 million people in urgent need of aid in Sudan, the verdict of the UN's top relief official. And Republicans in the US Senate vote down a border security bill that was tied to new money for Ukraine and Israel.
First, Republicans said they would only do Ukraine and Israel humanitarian aid with border. Then they said they would not do it with border. Well, we're going to give them both options.
Also in this podcast...
I arrived in Ireland on Monday. I seek for asylum. They don't have accommodation for single men. I'm just sleeping on the streets.
Why Ireland is struggling to cope with a big influx of asylum seekers. And it all goes wrong for the man who spent 8 years building the world's tallest Eiffel Tower made of matchsticks. The US Secretary of State Antony Blinken's hopes of achieving a ceasefire deal in Gaza have been pilloried by the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Mr. Blinken, who's visiting the Middle East, spent Wednesday in Israel discussing a proposal from Hamas for a four-month ceasefire. It is reportedly offering to release the remaining Israeli hostages in exchange for Israel withdrawing its forces from populated areas of Gaza and releasing Palestinian prisoners. Mr. Netanyahu rejected this outright. His words are spoken by a translator.
If we surrender to the crazy demands of Hamas, we'll not only not bring to their release, but we'll invite a second massacre, a great catastrophe for the state of Israel that any of our civilians is ready to accept. And regarding the day after the war, I'm asking to clarify once again, the day after is the day after Hamas. Not part of Hamas, not half of Hamas. The entire Hamas. And today I told Secretary of the State Blinken that after we devastate Hamas, we will make sure that Gaza is completely demilitarized forever.
In his news conference later, the US Secretary of State struck a slightly more hopeful tone.
We had an opportunity today to discuss with the Israeli government the response that Hamas sent last night to the proposal that the United States, Qatar, and Egypt had put together to bring the remaining hostages home and extend the humanitarian pause. What I can tell you about these discussions is that while there are some clear non-starters in Hamas's response, we do think it creates space for agreement to be reached. And we will work at that relentlessly until we get there.
Antony Blinken. Our correspondent Barbara Plett-Usher in Jerusalem told James Menendez more about what Mr. Netanyahu's comments meant for the peace process.
It sounded like he was slamming the door shut on a ceasefire and hostage deal, didn't it? And it sounds as if Mr. Blinken's sticking his toe in the door. He just said that he thought that there was some space for an agreement to be reached. He also didn't say what bit was the non-starter, but I think probably one thing that he and Mr. Netanyahu were referring to is that Hamas had said a temporary truce must eventually lead to a withdrawal of Israeli troops and a permanent ceasefire, something that Israel has rejected all along. I think that Antony Blinken and the Americans, as well as the Egyptians and the Qataris, they are quite focused on the need for a ceasefire. Mr. Blinken has called it essential. And that has to do with getting the hostages released, the remaining hostages, but also getting a pause in the fighting so that humanitarian aid can be brought into Gaza because the situation is so terribly desperate. And on top of that, the Americans are very intent on trying to lay the groundwork for a more fulsome resolution of the conflict. They have a whole formula for it, which he keeps talking about. So he is quite determined to pursue that. We don't know if other people in the Israeli government told him different things than Mr. Netanyahu did. Others certainly weren't as public about it or as defiant about it. But it's something that Mr. Blinken has taken in his stride anyway and is clearly not planning to give up.
Is it possible then that what we're hearing in public, both from Hamas and from Israel, are their sort of maximalist positions in these negotiations, and actually what we're not hearing about is some sort of compromise that may emerge in the coming days and weeks?
That's a possibility, yes, that we are hearing maximal positions. I do think that the Americans probably expected Mr. Netanyahu to respond negatively. I don't know if they expected him to be quite so public about it, but as Mr. Blinken said, some things were non-starters. I mean, it was interesting in the Hamas proposals, they have all along said that there needs to be a permanent ceasefire, but they talked about different phases, so that there was the first phase, which would result in the release of some hostages and the release of some Palestinian prisoners, did not require a guarantee of an end to the war. That was going to be coming in the later phases, according to the Hamas proposals, with further negotiations. So they were sort of signaling, I think, that they were ready to get started on the process. Perhaps that is where Mr. Blinken saw the space, although he didn't clarify that. He was pretty clear, though, that he did not see a role for Hamas in governing Gaza when and if the war ends. He's with the Israelis on that, but he also is very insistent that something needs to be done to stop the fighting. And he was also quite forthcoming in stressing the need to protect civilians. He talked about it at length. He said the Americans were pressing the Israelis to do more to protect civilians, and he had outlined steps to increase that.
Barbara Platt-Usher in Jerusalem. An American drone strike has killed three members of an Iranian-backed militia in Baghdad, including a leader of the group Kataib Hezbollah. The US military said he was behind recent attacks on US bases in Iraq and Syria. Officials said no civilians were killed, and Washington would continue to take necessary action to protect Americans. Hugo Bashega reports from Baghdad.
The attack happened at around 9:30 at night in an eastern district of the capital. Footage shared on social media showed the car engulfed in flames. One of the victims has been identified as Abu Bakir al-Sadi, a senior commander in the group Kataib Hezbollah. This is a militia supported by Iran and accused by U.S. officials of being behind an attack on a U.S. base in Jordan that killed three American soldiers last month. Days ago, the U.S. responded by carrying out airstrikes on militia targets in Iraq and Syria. The attack in Baghdad will raise fears of an escalation of violence in Iraq as it brings the U.S. retaliation to the country's capital. Shortly after the strike, crowds gathered at the scene chanting, "America is the biggest devil."
Hugo Bashega. The United Nations has appealed for $4.1 billion to fund humanitarian operations in Sudan. The appeal came on the same day that both warring factions agreed to meet in Switzerland to discuss access for aid supplies. The UN says 25 million people, half of Sudan's population, are in need. Sudan's conflict erupted last year in a power struggle between rival military leaders. Imogen Folks reports from Geneva.
Sudan's crisis needs attention it isn't getting. 9 million people displaced, 18 million short of food, widespread sexual violence. Without support, the UN's humanitarian coordinator, Martin Griffiths, said starvation could be next.
If we start seeing famine to add to this violence and displacement, then I think we can all agree we have no humanity.
The UN faces lack of funds and lack of access in Sudan. Many people are trapped in conflict areas with little food or water. The UN will struggle to get the cash it needs. Donor attention remains focused on Ukraine and the Middle East.
Imogen Folks. Our Africa editor Richard Hamilton told me more about the situation on the ground in Sudan.
The UN has called it suffering of epic proportions. And just some examples, a place south of the capital Khartoum in Al Jazeera state called Wad Madani, where hundreds of thousands of refugees had fled, and then the rapid support forces took over that place. So that meant that the refugees had to move on again. So nowhere is a safe haven within Sudan. And then a couple of days ago, Médecins Sans Frontières said that a child was dying every 2 hours in a refugee camp in North Darfur near El Fasher. It's almost impossible to convey the suffering of the Sudanese people at the hands of these two warring military leaders who don't seem to care about the situation that the population's in.
And this is starting to have an impact on neighbouring countries.
Yes. The UN is, the part of this $4 billion that it's calling for is to help countries like Chad, South Sudan, Ethiopia, Egypt, Central African Republic. For example, Chad, they're getting thousands of refugees every day and they simply can't cope. It's already one of the poorest countries in the world. And the same with South Sudan, which was recovering from its own civil war, a very poor country, is having to take hundreds of thousands of refugees. So they're at breaking point as well. There are worries about a wider regional conflict because you've got Egypt supporting the regular Sudanese armed forces, then the United Arab Emirates supporting the rapid support forces. So it's a complicated regional picture.
Presumably, the best way to improve the situation would be if the fighting stopped.
That, of course, would be the ideal situation. And the leaders often say, oh, we're going to hold talks. And the latest is there's the possibility of negotiations being held in Switzerland to allow access to humanitarian aid. But people aren't holding their breath that these are going to work.
Richard Hamilton. The Eurovision final might be 3 months away, but one of this year's acts has already stoked debate online and even amongst politicians. Spain's entry, which is called Zorra, has come under fire for being anti-women. Our reporter Ella Bicknell has this look at the story.
In the last week alone, the electro-pop anthem Zorra has rocketed to the top of Spanish streaming platforms. In fact, today Spotify had it as its third most viral tune worldwide. But the song's title has received backlash. Zorra means vixen, but is often used to mean bitch or slut in everyday Spanish. A group called the Feminist Movement of Madrid released a statement saying the song insults women in a sexist way, but others say it challenges stereotypes, including the Prime Minister, Pedro Sanchez, and Luis, a Spanish journalist and Eurovision fan.
I definitely don't think Zorra is an anti-women song. It is a song that comes from the experience of the singer, Mary, and where she's been called that bad name many times throughout her life, and now she's using it as a weapon against those who attacked her.
Zorra is performed by Nebulosa, a duo formed by a married couple from Alicante, Mary Baz and Mark D'Souz. Mary, who's the lead singer, brushed off the criticism, saying her age, she's 55, means she doesn't give a damn about anything. The group made headlines last year when they split from Spain's main feminist movement, the AM Commission, over its support of trans rights legislation. Dr. Paul Jordan wrote a PhD on the politics behind Eurovision.
I totally understand where people are coming from when they say it's misogynistic and that it's insulting to women. But I would agree really with those who are defending it, who are saying that actually it's challenging stereotypes. And I think certainly the use of language, I think they're using it to reclaim that language, to take out the power of those words, much in the way that LGBT people have reclaimed the word queer.
Despite the row, the song has been given the go-ahead by contest organisers. They've confirmed it does not contravene its ban on lyrics that can be used to bring the contest into disrepute. So we'll be seeing Nebulosa and their song Zorra at the Eurovision Song Contest in Malmo in May.
Ella Bicknell. Now, good news for a pod of killer whales that became trapped in drift ice off the coast of Japan. They appear to have escaped to open water. Concern for the fate of the whales had been growing in Japan after drone video had shown at least 10 orcas crowded together in the ice for days. Sean Wales reports.
The video is hard to watch. Around a dozen killer whales packed together, trapped in ice and struggling to breathe. The orcas can be seen bobbing around in a small hole in the ice, sticking their heads out for air. The icy water appears to be tainted red, suggesting some of the orcas had bleeding jaws. Earlier this week, a fisherman reported the whales had become stuck in ice about a kilometre off the coast of the northern Japanese island Hokkaido. Drone video of the whales was broadcast on Japanese TV, sparking public concern. Unlike many other large whales, orcas can't spend long underwater, no more than about 15 minutes. One environmental group petitioned the Japanese government to deploy an icebreaker to help free the animals, but officials said there was little they could do to help. Orcas have been reported dying in ice in this area in the past. But on Wednesday, there was good news for the trapped animals, officials saying they believed growing gaps in the ice helped the orcas free themselves and swim to open water. Sea ice covers Hokkaido's coast every winter, but researchers say climate change has resulted in a 30% decline in sea ice across the region over the past four decades.
Sean, Wales. And for more ice-related content, you can head to the BBC News website, where you can see the winner of this year's Wildlife Photographer of the Year People's Choice Award. A stunning image of a young polar bear drifting off to sleep on an iceberg has taken the prize. Well worth a look. Still to come on the Global News podcast.
They're absolutely beautiful, and quite a lot of people agree with me. Some people don't.
Can you see them from where you live?
No, I can't. But I would love to.
One of the creators of the wind turbine on its aesthetic appeal and winning a highly coveted award. It wasn't the result President Biden had been calling for. The US Senate has voted down a bipartisan bill authorizing US aid to Ukraine and Israel, whilst also tightening the US-Mexican border. Worth $118 billion and months in the making, it failed to reach the 60 votes needed to go through to the House of Representatives after an intervention from Donald Trump, who's vocally opposed to the deal. But it leaves aid to Ukraine and Israel up in the air, an issue raised by the National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan during today's visit to NATO headquarters in Brussels.
We need to move forward a package of support for Ukraine. At the end of the day, there is no alternative to the United States stepping up to the plate and providing a level of resources that allow Ukraine to have the artillery, the air defense systems, and the other capabilities they need. And time is of the essence in this regard.
Well, as we recorded this podcast, Congress was still in session, with the Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer now pushing to separate the border issue from aid to Ukraine and Israel. So how did the bill fall apart? Our correspondent in Washington is John Sudworth.
This process began with high hopes, Alex, that this might be a way to get a deal not just on the US border, but on the US's international commitments, aid to Ukraine and to Israel too. Republicans had said all along that they wouldn't approve any of that new military aid unless President Biden enacts measures to curtail the number of migrants crossing America's southern border. And in the end, Mr. Biden called their bluff. Democrats were licensed to work hard with their partners across the aisle. In the end, what they drew up were some of the toughest restrictions on migration in U.S. history, according to many respected commentators. But, and here's the rub, you know, with Donald Trump now the leading contender for the Republican nomination and seemingly unwilling to offer anything that would give Mr. Biden the appearance of a win ahead of that election, he's been urging his party now to reject the deal. So having marched everybody up this hill, they've all marched back down again. And Republicans almost overwhelmingly in the Senate today, just four Republican members voting for these measures. And so this big package, this big hopeful bipartisan piece of work that's taken months to craft looks like it can go no further.
Although presumably President Biden would want to try and turn that on its head and use it as ammunition against Mr. Trump.
Well, of course, you know, some people have suggested that in all of this, the Republicans have set a trap that they themselves have now stumbled into. It allows Democrats to point the finger at them and say that everything they were calling for, or at least most of everything they were calling for, was there on the table. And in the end, for narrow party advantage, they have chosen to put party interests ahead of border security. But the focus, Alex, given everything else you've been discussing already, is still on that military aid to Ukraine. There is still hope in the Senate that they can separate some of those measures out from this immigration part of the equation now. And, you know, as you've been hearing, there is real concern that Ukraine is in desperate need of this aid, that its ability to repel Russian aggression is already depleted. And Democrats now working very hard to see if they can find a way through to win enough Republican support to at least keep that part of the bargain alive.
John Sudworth. For generations, Irish people have emigrated overseas, but now the reverse has happened and increasing numbers of immigrants have been trying to make it their home. Around 100,000 Ukrainians arrived after the EU granted them temporary protection, and the numbers of people seeking refuge in Ireland has quadrupled compared to pre-COVID times. In December, the government ran out of options to house all new eligible arrivals, and some people strongly oppose new accommodation. As Bob Howard reports, that's resulted in men seeking asylum being forced to sleep in tents in freezing winter temperatures.
Ringsend is a suburb of the Irish capital, Dublin, close to the city's port. There's a church, a cafe, a local shop, and a yellow-painted pub called the Shipwright. On New Year's Eve, the pub was subjected to an arson attack in the mistaken belief that it was going to be used to house refugees. It's one of several attacks which have had the potential to dent Ireland's reputation as the country of 100,000 welcomes. Hazel Chu is a Dublin city councillor with a special interest in housing and immigration in the city.
What we're looking at is a burnt-out building. To be clear, it was designated to be a homeless hub, yet still there were groups saying that they would be burning it down because they thought it was going to be an international protection accommodation centre to house people who were not Irish.
I arrived in Ireland on Monday and I seek for asylum. Currently, they don't have accommodation for single men. And we don't have anywhere to sleep. We're just sleeping on the streets.
The shortage of suitable accommodation has left more than 600 men like Joseph, who's from Zimbabwe, without a roof over their heads.
Families, they are allocated, but we are all vulnerable. Anything can happen to us. We just get into our tents and our sleeping bags, that's it.
The government has increased payments for some international protection applicants. That's refugees who say they're in danger of persecution or serious harm in their home country. Those who are not being housed will see an increase from €38 to €113 a week. The Lighthouse, 5 minutes by car from the Irish Parliament, offers support to anybody who finds themselves homeless in the capital. Aubrey McCarthy is the voluntary chair of Tiglin, which runs the service.
We used to feed maybe 20 to 40 people a day. At the moment, we're feeding about 500 people every day here. I would say majority of them are sleeping rough. Certainly since Christmas, we've had a lot of rough sleepers.
To try and house refugees, the Irish government has been sourcing accommodation, not just in big cities like Dublin, but towns and even villages throughout the Irish countryside. Rural politicians such as Michael Collins, who represents Cork South West, says this is putting pressure on local services.
Doctor can't take any more newcomers coming in. The school is looking for two extra rooms and they can't take the extra kids. They should have been a cap at a very early time and look after those who come in properly. They're sleeping on the streets. That's no way to treat anyone.
The Irish government says people have a right to seek international protection under EU law and international law, and it's investing in more state-owned accommodation to house people seeking asylum. Roderick O'Gorman is the government's Minister for Integration.
I'm looking at how we have more state-owned accommodation, but our hospitals, our healthcare system, our social care system would collapse without migrants. So if we were to sometime in the future as a country take a decision to keep migrants out, we would be absolutely shooting ourselves in the foot.
Ireland is trying to tread a fine balance. It has EU and international obligations to house refugees while their claims are processed. And it relies on migrants from many different countries and circumstances to work across whole sectors of the economy. But the tensions in accommodating and providing services for them are very real, something which Irish politicians from across the board are going to have to address.
Bob Howard. Dutch prosecutors say a man arrested in Spain in connection with a massive jewel heist at Amsterdam's Schiphol Airport 19 years ago is the man convicted of being the crime's mastermind. They could not say whether a DNA test has been carried out on the suspect, but named him as Errol H.V. Danny Eberhardt has more details.
It was one of the world's biggest ever jewel robberies. An armed gang dressed as airline staff seized a haul of diamonds worth over $70 million. The consignment had been due to be flown to Antwerp, the centre of the world's diamond trade. Many years later, four of the gang were sentenced to jail terms, but the leader, Errol H.V., was released while a lengthy appeals process played out. The Supreme Court eventually confirmed his 9.5-year sentence, but he'd absconded. Spanish police arrested a man in Ibiza on Tuesday. They said he looked much younger and thinner than the photos they had, adding they couldn't rule out him having had cosmetic surgery. The Dutch hoped to extradite him. Many of the stolen diamonds have not been recovered.
Danny Eberhardt. Two men who pioneered the early design principles for wind turbines have been awarded this year's Queen Elizabeth Prize, nicknamed the Nobel for Engineering. The judges said their innovations had changed the world. One of the winners, Andrew Garrett, told Justin Webb why he thought he'd been awarded the prestigious prize.
Well, I got it, I think, for the last 45 years of my life. I've devoted that to wind energy. You know, so when I started, wind turbines were 5 metres in diameter, and now they're 250 metres in diameter, and I'm rather pleased to have played a small part in that development.
Your part is the mathematical part, is it? The computer part?
My abiding enthusiasm is mathematical modelling, and that's been quite an important element in allowing these huge machines to grow and be run reliably. So, yes, the turbine design, mathematical modelling of that, mathematical modelling of the way the wind farms themselves perform and whether they're going to produce the right amount of energy for the banks. So, really, mathematical rigour applied to the whole range of activity, from the turbines right through to generation into the grid.
That modelling is so important, of course, because there has to be an economic case for doing it. That economic case has to make sense.
Yes, well, I think if you can imagine building something which is 250 metres in diameter and it failing, would be a very big deal. So you need to know before you do it that it's going to work. And so we've managed to develop models which predict really pretty accurately how these things will behave. And so people have the confidence to build them and confidence to invest
in them. You're obviously an enthusiast for wind power. Are you winning the kind of worldwide battle that there is? Because, well, I mean, you only have to look around this country. A lot of people find them ugly, don't want them where they can see them. And yet, of course, there is no doubt at all that in certain circumstances they can work very well. What's the state of that battle, would you say?
Yes, I think you're right. That people either see them as symbols of clean power for the future or they see them as blots on the landscape. I think opinion is moving much towards the former. People are recognising that we need to have zero carbon generation. There was a survey done recently in the UK which showed that wind turbines were more popular than baked beans. So I think that's a very good indication of their growing popularity.
Yep.
And we also, I think we've probably, as an industry, done a very bad job at communicating how much we're doing. So last year, 39% of our electricity in the UK was produced by renewables, which is, frankly, to use a technical term, gobsmacking. 15 years ago, that was probably 3%. So, yes, in Northern Europe, we are not winning the battle, but we're making big progress. 7% of the world's electricity is now produced by wind, 39%, as I said last year.
Do you think we'll just get used to them?
Of course, I'm not objective, I recognise
that.
No,
I'm not asking you to be objective.
I think they're absolutely beautiful, and quite a lot of people agree with me. Some people don't.
Can you see them from where you live?
No, I can't, but I would love to. But I think there is a move in a positive direction. As you can imagine, I've often had to defend the position, and people say they don't like them. So I say, OK, well, you can't be against everything. Unless you're against electricity, you've got to be for something. So you're against wind? OK, so what are you for? So we need to make a positive decision about how we're going to generate electricity. One very successful part is wind. Last year, the Queen Elizabeth Prize was awarded to solar energy. Those two together, they're not competitors, they're collaborators.
Wind turbine inventor Andrew Garrett. A French model maker who wanted to build the biggest ever replica of the Eiffel Tower out of matchsticks has seen his dream turn to ashes. He's been told his masterpiece does not qualify for a Guinness World Record because he used the wrong type of match. From Paris, here's Hugh Schofield.
Imagine the disappointment. You spend 8 years of your life painstakingly constructing a 7.2-metre-high model of the Eiffel Tower out of tiny sticks of wood and glue. You unveil your achievement and call in the Guinness Record Book judges, only to be told you did it all wrong. The unfortunate Richard Plour realised early on in his enterprise, so around the year 2016, that the worst part of the job was scratching off the tiny red bits of sulphur from the heads of the matchsticks, and there were going to be more than 700,000 overall. So he thought he'd cut a corner by going directly to the matchstick manufacturers, who were happy to supply him with kilos and kilos of matchsticks without the sulphur heads. Sadly, the stipulation in the Guinness rules, which he only consulted when he'd nearly completed the model, is that matchsticks have to be commercially available, which his obviously weren't. And so the Guinness World Record does not come home to France, but stays in Lebanon, where judges have authenticated a shorter 6.5-metre tower, made with the right kind of matches.
Hugh Schofield. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News Podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Joe McCartney, and the producer was Emma Joseph. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.